Richard Strauss is a hard man to pin down. As an artist, he was never tied to a single style.
He was a very facile composer. I mean, he could write with an ease that's incredible.
Some of his tone poems, just the sound of them, were quite shocking.
Sometimes we read of the soprano riding the orchestra, kind of surfing the wave of the orchestra.
Richard Strauss embraced many musical forms during his lifetime. There was only one guiding principle, his artistic compass, that music is a holy art. He set those very words to music in his opera, Ariadne of Naxos. For Strauss, this was far more than a line in a libretto. It was a way of life. In this three-part series, we'll explore many sides of Strauss, and in this second segment, we'll examine his operas. I'm soprano Debbie Voigt. Welcome to Music is a Holy Art, a Richard Strauss celebration from WQXR in New York. After writing the tone poems, a profound shift took place in Strauss's musical output. He turned to opera. Here's Strauss scholar Brian Gilliam.
And if you look at a composer such as Verdi or Wagner, those are composers who started out in the theater from the very outset. They were men of the theater.
Strauss had spent much of his life composing instrumental works, as well as a lot of songs.
But as a young man, he loved to go to the theater.
Strauss had written two operas during the time of the tone poems, but neither had been a success. When he got to his third, he tried something different. He centered the whole thing on a female character.
Look at Wagner. You've got Siegfried, Lohengrin, Parsifal, Tannhäuser. These are all major male roles. Strauss absolutely reverses this trend by having all female roles.
And no other major opera composer would write as many operas centered on their female stars. Of Strauss's 15 operas, most of them are named after their female protagonists. This would become his trademark. It begins with a pair of iconic operas, Salome and Elektra.
With Salome and Elektra, Strauss brought in the 20th century, in my mind, just as much as Stravinsky with The Rite of Spring.
That's James Conlon, music director of the Los Angeles Opera. Salome premiered in 1905, Elektra in 1909, both well before The Rite of Spring in 1913. Strauss would boldly push the limits of orchestral sound further than anyone had ever heard before.
And then another radical step is the brazen choice of subjects that shock. And this, of course, is the first time that there's an aesthetic of ugliness. And I mean an aesthetic of ugliness not just in sound, but in behavior. I mean, of course, there have always been villains and bad people in operas, and it's made of that. But it goes to a new degree here. I mean, Salome, the actions of Salome go well beyond anything that had been normal, so to speak, in opera before that.
Salome is the story of a Judean princess, a teenage girl, who becomes infatuated with the prophet Yohanan, John the Baptist. He rejects her totally. Salome's stepfather, King Herod, then asks her to dance erotically for him, offering anything she wishes in exchange. And after she does a striptease for her stepfather, she asks for the head of John the Baptist on a silver platter, which she gets.
And it's an opera that's a very disturbing opera. It's anti-religious. It makes fun of Christianity. It makes fun of Judaism.
All of this was in the original play by Oscar Wilde, which Strauss used as his libretto.
But he's got incest, necrophilia, You choose the scandalous part and you will get it. Cutting someone's head off and kissing a decapitated head, what could be more disgusting than that?
Strauss fully intended to shock.
Oh, he understood the appeal of sensationalism, no doubt about it.
That's music writer Paul Thomason, who's written extensively on Strauss.
It was a success. It was also extremely scandalous, of course, not only because of the subject matter and the fact that the music very clearly conveys all the neurotic eroticism of this severed head and this teenage girl who's gone nuts, but also some of the dissonance in the music. And it was a huge orchestra.
One of the most shocking places is the very end of the opera. Salome is kissing the severed head of John the Baptist.
When she says, "I've kissed your mouth," there's almost an orgasm over just the way Dinah moved. It's really pretty shocking.
After Salome, Strauss wanted to do a comedy, something totally different. But then he came across a play and a playwright that made him reconsider. After Salome, Strauss wrote Elektra.
Salome dazzles, Elektra overwhelms. It is Elektra's hatred from beginning to end.
Elektra really wants to avenge the murder of her father, Agamemnon. The murder was committed by her mother, Clytemnestra, and her mother's lover. And Elektra is obsessed with the idea of avenging her father's death. That's her only reason for living.
Similar to Salome, Elektra was successful, but also very shocking.
So it's an opera that's really about obsession and revenge and the price that puts on a person and how consuming that will be. And it seemed at the time to be such dissonance. Strauss expresses in the orchestra some of the brutal emotions very vividly.
This was the first opera that Strauss wrote with Hugo von Hofmannsthal, launching a creative partnership that would last until 1929 and produce many of Strauss's most successful operas. Strauss had seen a production of Hofmannsthal's play Elektra and then worked with him to adapt the text for the opera.
And that's how it all started, because Hofmannsthal did a very good job and was cooperative.
The original story of Elektra comes from ancient Greece, but Hofmannsthal gives it a distinctly modern reading. He was living in Vienna in the early 1900s and was well aware of Freud's groundbreaking experiments.
I think Hofmannsthal is doing, to a certain extent, what Freud tried to do. Explain through mythology a common language in Western Europe to explain deeper psychological insights.
Most of this opera is populated by women, but there is one significant male role, that of Orest, Elektra's brother. He shows up in the middle of the drama.
And she shrieks his name, Orest. And the orchestra then vividly depicts her mind totally disintegrating. It just goes right out of any sense of tonality. And then within a moment or so comes back and there's this wonderful caressing lullaby melody, as if she's reverted to being an infant again.
Ultimately, it's Orest who commits the murder Elektra has been longing for.
It's a very deeply cathartic opera at the end. Strauss is not just, he's not a voyeur. He's letting us feel how fulfilled Elektra is at the end.
After Zalame and Elektra, such heavy music and subject matter, Strauss decided it was time to change gears. It was time for a romantic comedy. Der Rosenkavalier, or The Knight of the Rose, is Strauss's most famous opera. The knight is a male character, but he is sung by a mezzo-soprano. For Strauss, even his best male characters must be women. Here's the plot.
Young aristocrat named Octavian grows up from being the young lover of the Marshalin, who's older than him, to finding the woman for him, whom he can rescue and who will then look up to him.
Like the tone poem Don Juan, we start with a very sexually explicit musical depiction. Octavian is making love to the Marshalin before the curtain rises. The audience only hears the music.
There's no doubt in the orchestra whatsoever what's going on and who is doing what to whom. And the horns are Octavian.
Hofmannsthal throws together many elements to create this story. He mixes French comedy with Italian comedy, but sets it in Vienna during the 18th century reign of the Habsburg Empress Maria Theresa. Back to Brian Gilliam.
And it's a wonderful amalgam of sources for Hofmannsthal, but it's also a wonderful amalgam of types and styles of music.
You have music that sounds like Mozart. You have music that sounds like Verdi. You have music that sounds like Johann Strauss, the great waltz king, and no relation to Richard Strauss. And, of course, the overflowing chromatic music of Richard Strauss himself. In the middle of all this, there is a love triangle, which allows Strauss and Hofmannsthal to examine relationships from several different points of view.
Well, it has to do with what is love, what are the stages of love, how does one cope with the passage of time and the fact that life is constantly something new that we have to adapt to and yet be ourselves.
Strauss and Hofmannsthal modeled Octavian on another male character sung by a woman, the beloved Cherubino from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. Octavian's most famous scene is in the middle of Act II, when he presents young Sophie with a silver rose from her suitor, Baron Ox. And Strauss, ever the visual composer, depicts silver in music.
He does it by the use of flutes, harps, and celeste, and they're playing in a different key to the rest of the orchestra, so you have this polytonality. Silver really is striking. It stands out. It's bright.
Listen closely, and you can hear the sound of silver sparkling in the orchestra. During this glorious presentation, Octavian realizes he himself is attracted to Sophie. They sing a duet, which is exactly the vocal sound that has come to be known as Straussian. For the final scene of Der Rosenkavalier, Hofmannsthal thought the plot had lost momentum. It was going to be boring.
Strauss said, "You're going to have to trust me on this one. I think I know what I'm doing. I think you'll like it."
The opera ends with a magnificent trio, a high point of the opera, and the most famous music of Strauss's operatic output. Strauss and Hofmannsthal would continue to experiment by stirring up many different elements within each work. For their next opera, Ariadne auf Naxos, they broke traditional format by giving us an opera within a play. Paul Thomason gives us the specifics.
Well, in the prologue, we have a story that a serious opera has to be presented at the same time as a commedia dell'arte troupe doing their nonsense, and they have to be combined. They have to happen at the same time.
Amid the backstage chaos, we meet the composer of the opera to be performed, and Strauss insisted that he be played by a woman. The composer proclaims that music is a holy art. Musik ist ein heilige Kunst. Eventually, the real opera begins, and we meet a trio of nymphs. And then we meet our protagonist, Ariadne, who's been left on the island of Naxos by her lover.
From Hofmannsthal's point of view, it's about how does one go on with life after losing a great love.
But Ariadne is not the only protagonist in this opera.
Suddenly there's this group of traveling actors who's there, led by a coquette and a dancer named Zerbinetta.
Ariadne is a one-man woman who's been dumped. And Zerbinetta juggles her love between four different men at once.
Two completely opposite views of what life is about, presented simultaneously.
In Zerbinetta, Strauss created one of his most original female roles.
It's a very sparkling role. She's a very sparkling character. She's fast.
That's soprano Diana Domrau, who has sung the role many times. All of the Strauss roles are hard to sing, but this one is especially challenging.
For sure, you need a lot of stamina. The big aria is surrounded by nice quintets. You have to dance and jump, and then you're suddenly alone. And the end of the aria is very, very high, is stratospheric. You have to be able to trill there at the end and not to die out of exhaustion. Yeah.
You might have noticed there are practically no men in this opera. Strauss did not care for tenors, and when he did write for them, he made the music exceptionally difficult. Here's writer Kathleen Watt, who specializes in opera and the performing arts.
Some of his roles are actually known as tenor killers. Bacchus is one of those from Ariadne.
Bacchus doesn't appear until the very end of the evening. Strauss gives us an opera jam-packed with women. Back to Kathleen Watt.
I would say, in modern parlance, that he was in touch with his feminine side. I think, though, that he seems to have maintained a curiosity, an enthusiasm, and a genuine admiration for the women, the real women, who are in his real life, for the intricacies of women's psychology as they approach the multiple roles and the multifaceted roles that are traditionally considered women's roles throughout real life.
So it's no surprise that Strauss preferred female characters in his operas. Hofmannsthal, too, was on the same page. Brian Gilliam.
This is why the collaboration lasted so long. It's because Hofmannsthal also preferred female characters. He found that the female character, a more profound type of character. He felt that women were far more complex men, and you see this in all of the operas that he wrote the texts for.
In their next opera, Die Frau ohne Schatten, The Woman Without a Shadow, Strauss would make better use of the male voice. But again, it's a female-dominated opera with three main female leads.
The basic story is that the empress must get a shadow within 3 days or her husband's going to be turned to stone. So it's a fairy tale about how does she do this?
Hofmannsthal drew on several different fairy tales, combined them together, and added elements of his own, ultimately coming up with his most complicated plot so far.
Two couples with marital issues. Different types, but marital issues nonetheless.
It would also be Strauss's most complex score. The first couple is the emperor and his wife, the empress. She is the woman without a shadow. The second couple is Barak and his wife, a couple based on Strauss and his wife. They sing a duet for baritone and soprano, one of the few Strauss wrote.
It's all about making a marriage work, rededicating yourself to your marriage.
And the whole idea of transformation. How does one become all one can be, all one should be, without causing harm to other people? It's a very central theme.
Strauss and Hofmannsthal both believed that we transform ourselves through marriage.
And this is really Hofmannsthal talking. We are people, we need to reach a higher plane. That comes with marriage and commitment to another person. And then we are transformed after we have a child. We're never the same, he said. And that's the whole theme of Die Frau ohne Schatten, the woman without a shadow who cannot conceive, and she has to be transformed.
The theme of transformation runs through much of Strauss's work. In the operas, we often see that it is a woman who must take a risk. She must make a choice, and in doing so, transform herself. Another theme Strauss returns to frequently is ancient Greece and Greek myths. We saw it in Electra and Ariadne of Naxos. We see it again in the Egyptian Helen, an opera focused on Helen of Troy after the Trojan War as she tries to put her marriage back together. More from Paul Thomason.
So this is another one of those marriage operas. What makes a good marriage? What makes it honest? How can they see each other for who they really are, not for who they think or want the other person to be?
This is the first time Strauss wrote an extended tenor role with Hofmannsthal, but it's still the music for Helen that steals the show. The opera is, after all, named after her, not her husband. The next opera Strauss and Hofmannsthal wrote together was Arabella, again named for its heroine. Hofmannsthal rated some of his earlier works for different elements of the story.
Arabella has to make a good marriage to save her family from bankruptcy. So it's how does she, on the one hand, do what she needs to do as a good girl, but wait for the right guy.
Strauss and Hofmannsthal set out to create a kind of Rosenkavalier part two, and certainly the duet Arabella has with her sister brings back memories of Octavian and Sophie in Rosenkavalier. In addition to the music, there are other similarities to Rosenkavalier.
We again have Vienna. We again have somebody looking to get married. But he wrote a really wonderful part for a bass baritone in the role of Mandrika.
Sadly, Arabella would be the final opera Strauss and Hofmannsthal would write. This would be the last time the two great artists would soar together. Strauss and Hofmannsthal were working on the libretto. They had rough drafts of all three acts and had just finished the final version of Act One. Strauss sent Hofmannsthal a telegram saying, "Congratulations, I just received the finished Act One. It's perfect. I'm going to start composing." Here's Brian Gilliam.
And it arrived the day that Hofmannsthal died. And even worse, Hofmannsthal's son had died 2 days earlier. He was on his way to his son's funeral. He was getting dressed for the funeral. He said to his wife, "I feel a little tired." He sat down in a chair and collapsed.
Hofmannsthal died of grief. Strauss was shattered.
He thought he'd never compose again. But when Strauss faced a crisis, he always worked his way out of it by composing.
In honor of Hofmannsthal, Strauss would set Acts 2 and 3 exactly as Hofmannsthal had written them, rather than making any revisions he certainly would have made if Hofmannsthal had still been alive. Arabella would be a tribute to his great collaborator of more than 20 years. In later years, Strauss tried a few more librettists. He worked with the great Austrian writer Stefan Zweig and quite enjoyed it, but the collaboration ended because the Nazis came to power and Zweig, being Jewish, fled Europe. His next collaborator was Josef Gregor, a theater historian that Zweig had recommended. Although they wrote several operas together, it was not a happy collaboration. Gregor was simply not the artist Hofmannsthal or Zweig had been.
And basically, Strauss took over entirely. And even in the published letters, there's some embarrassing moments where he says, "This is just flat out terrible, what you've done here. Can't you do anything better than this?" and that kind of stuff.
Even if the libretti were lacking, Strauss still composed some magnificent music, and many of the themes he and Hofmannsthal had meditated on find their way into the Strauss-Gregor operas. Women are still in the center of everything, such as the opera Daphne.
Daphne has to protect herself from the god Apollo's advances, which she's not interested in, and is turned into a laurel tree.
The opera ends with Daphne as the laurel tree, singing a wordless melody over the orchestra. Strauss and Hofmannsthal had once discussed an opera about another mythical Greek character, Danae, but they never wrote it. Strauss tried this with Gregor. The result was Die Liebe der Danae, The Love of Danae.
The story basically is that Danae, who adores gold, has to choose between Midas and the god Jupiter.
Midas makes a grand entry, a visual spectacle that Strauss matches in sound.
He comes down to her in a shower of gold. It's a beautiful, beautiful scene, very phantasmagoric, like the silver music of the Rosenkavalier. This is the gold music.
This is the most Wagnerian of the Strauss operas. It's about choosing between love and gold, which is the central theme of Wagner's Ring Cycle.
You know, the ring is really more about, when it comes to the gold, the discussion of gold, it's Alberich and Fafner and Siegfried and all that. It's a very, very male-oriented story.
There are many references to the ring in this opera, but Strauss and Gregor made it a female-centered story. It's Danae who must choose between love and gold.
And in a certain way, you can think of her as a Brunhilde-like character.
At the end of Wagner's Die Walküre, Wotan says farewell to Brunhilde in a blaze of instrumental music. And Strauss does the same. This time it is Jupiter who says farewell to Danae. Strauss's orchestra soars. In his final opera, Strauss co-wrote the libretto with conductor Clemens Krauss. It was called Capriccio. Paul Thomason.
He never thought of this as an opera that would be for the public. He always thought this would be a very select audience, if ever. He was doing it for his own enjoyment. It's about what goes into an opera. What's more important, the words or the music?
And in it, we see all the elements Strauss adored most. A female protagonist, the theme of marriage, and a very important choice to be made by the heroine.
The Countess must decide which of her two suitors, a poet or a composer, she's going to marry.
The whole premise of the opera is built around a love sonnet written by the poet. First, we hear a dramatic reading of the sonnet, then the composer tries his hand at setting the sonnet to music.
Kein anderes, was mir so im Herzen wohnt. Nein, schöne, nicht auf dieser ganzen Erde.
Eventually, the composer, countess, and poet discuss it as a trio. But before we get to the grand finale, we have a short interlude.
The moonlight music, which is the orchestral introduction to the final scene, is one of the most ravishing pieces of music Strauss ever wrote. The French horn has this gorgeous, gorgeous soaring melody that just tears your heart out.
And then the most famous moment of the opera. The Countess herself sings the sonnet as set to music by the composer. We have a double transformation. The words have become music, and the Countess has chosen her suitor, thereby transforming herself. A bittersweet end to Strauss's career composing operas.
Capriccio ends with the Countess having made up her mind, though she doesn't tell us, which of the two suitors she's going to choose the next morning. And as she goes off, being very satisfied, the horns play just a little bit of a little melody that's run throughout the opera.
So the horn has the last word.
And I think maybe Strauss is letting us know that he thinks she's going to choose the composer at that point.
Next time, we'll take a close look at Strauss himself and see if the man matches the music. You're listening to a three-part series from WQXR in New York. I'm soprano Debbie Voigt, and we are celebrating the great composer, Richard Strauss, a man who believed that music is a holy art.